ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A confession. A memory. A lie. What if all three could be wrong? Forensic is a new series from All in the Mind, unpacking the hidden psychology of crime solving. Why innocent people confess? How memories can be rewritten? The science behind true crime. All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
So you know the story of the Titanic, the luxury ship, which at the time of its fateful voyage in 1912 was the largest ever human-made structure built to move. Everything about it was mammoth. 52,000 tons of it, 11 decks in height, over 2,000 passengers. But do you know the story of Evelyn, the only Australian survivor of the Titanic disaster, a young nurse from rural South Australia? Well, one of Australia's most well-known journalists, Lisa Wilkinson, former co-host of Channel 10's The Project and Channel 9's Today Show, started digging. And what she unearthed in extraordinary detail is gobsmacking. It's a story told for the first time, and she tells it in her historical non-fiction book, already a number one bestseller, The Titanic Story of Evelyn. And Lisa joins me today at this Northern Books event on Djadjawarrang country in the Goldfields Victorian town of Castlemaine. Hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell, and this is ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas. So if I found this a wild read, what was it like to write?
It was a book I never thought I would write, because being married to Peter Fitzsimons for the many decades that I have been, watching the work that he has to put into the historical non-fiction works and the stories that he tells, it was something that was way too big for me to ever tackle. He'd already cornered that market. But one thing I did like being involved in with Pete's books was occasionally I would come up with an idea, and a couple of them have been printed and been very successful. But one particular day about 3 years ago, he was looking at a photograph of the Titanic, which had come up in some research for another book that he was doing. And I said to him, have you ever checked to see if there are any Australians on the Titanic? Because there could be an amazing story there for one of your next books. And he said, great idea. And no, I've never thought of that. And I said, well, the weird thing is, between your 40 years in journalism and my 40 years in journalism, I've never thought of it either. So there mustn't have been any Australians on the Titanic, because we would know about them.
And so it began.
So I said to him, you need to look into it. A couple of days went by and my husband did what most husbands do, completely ignored his wife's idea. And when I checked in with him, he said, no, I haven't looked into it, but I promise you it's a great idea and I will. And I thought, I've got a computer. I've heard of that thing called Google. I can look into it myself. And I did, and I was shocked to discover that there were actually six Australian passengers and crew on that maiden and only voyage of the Titanic, and only one survivor, a young 28-year-old kick-ass nurse from an hour and a half north of Adelaide, who, when I looked into her story, I realised that she was really reflecting the rise of the suffragettes at this turn of the century moment as she was growing up. I don't know if you know, but South Australia was only the second place on the planet where women got the right to vote, second only to New Zealand. They got it in 1894. The US didn't get it until 1920, and the UK didn't get it until 1928, which was a full decade after women could actually be voted into Parliament. So you could be a member of parliament in the UK, but you couldn't actually vote for yourself.
Although South Australia was where also women were first allowed to also run for parliament.
Yes.
So you discover this woman, young nurse, her name is Evelyn Marsden.
And so she was growing up with this ethos happening around her. And she was a champion horsewoman, but she didn't want to ride side saddle, like girls were meant to do back in those days. She always wanted to ride astride like her big brother Tommy, whom she hero worshipped. And her poor mother Annie finally gave in to her willful teenage daughter and made her a pair of culottes in order to save her dignity as she rode off with Tommy every afternoon. She wanted to help out her dad. She was the youngest of five children, daughter of the station master at Hoyleton. And the way she could help out her dad was to learn Morse code. And so she would fill in for her dad in the station master's office when the Morse code messages were coming in. She also loved to row, and she used to travel down to Murray Bridge and row on the Murray River. And she didn't want to row like the other people who rowed at Murray Bridge did, which was get in the rowboat and go out with the current, and then when the tidal flow turned, gently row back to shore. Evelyn always wanted to challenge herself, and so Evelyn would always row against the tide. Mm. And when I read those words in the few things that I could find about Evelyn on the internet, I thought, I wonder how many Australian women even now feel like they are constantly rowing against the tide.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I know I have many times. And so when I put all of this together...
I just love that. Can we just acknowledge that this woman is a very strong rower and she knows Morse code and she trains to be a nurse. It's almost like the Titanic was waiting for her.
Yeah.
I just want to go back, though, at the beginning of, you know, you do your Google search, her name pops up. Really, very little has been talked about Evelyn before. Her story had just only been told very minimally.
Mm.
So where do you start with a project like this? How do you start unravelling the mystery of a woman lost in time?
Well, she only ever gave two interviews, and that's the reason why this story never got any bigger than really sitting in the dark cobweb corners of the internet. So I figured the first thing I had to do was read everything I could get my hands on, of the biggest story of the Titanic. Mm. And that meant also listening to every podcast I could possibly listen to and watch all the movies and the documentaries that have ever been made about the Titanic, not all of which can agree with each other on the facts of the Titanic, but I wanted to understand that larger story so that I could decide which of those stories were going to help me tell Evelyn's story.
So you joined a very illustrious club, the Titanic Obsessives Club, because they're out there.
Oh, they certainly are.
If you're about to embark on telling the story of a Titanic survivor, you know that you're going to encounter these people.
But
it's a risky enterprise.
It is, but I couldn't think about them. I could only ever think about Evelyn and being true to her story and true to the story of the Titanic. But one of the things I discovered in doing that research is that, like so much of history, our history is told by men. And everything that I was seeing on the Titanic were stories being told by men. So I knew that there was an opportunity there when I discovered that there were so many incredible women on the Titanic. There were 434 of them, and they were everything from political activists to the highest paid, most famous movie star in the world at the time, the most celebrated fashion designer in Paris at the time, a big game hunter, don't condone, but wow, big game hunter, female at the turn of the century is extraordinary.
On the Titanic. Yeah.
Suffragettes, these incredible women. And I couldn't understand why their collective story had never been told, but I also knew that they were going to help me tell Evelyn's story. But the day came when I discovered that one of Evelyn's most precious relatives was still alive. She had a favourite niece, Mavis, and Mavis's daughter is still alive. She's 76 years of age. She lives in South Australia. And she was my absolute connection to Evelyn, because Patria holds all of the letters and all of the family folklore.
That is an absolute gift. She's the sole survivor of...
No, there are other family members, but Patria, because she was Evelyn's favourite niece's daughter, Mavis passed on all of that family folklore to Petrea. And Petrea has held Evelyn close to her heart all of her life.
And, so, the precious gift of an archive. So as you, so she gave you access to that archive.
An archive that no one else has ever seen.
Oh, that's incredible. So how did that archive tell Evelyn's story? Take us on the journey that explains how Evelyn ended up on the Titanic. This was the largest human-made moving structure ever.
Well, it had a sister ship called the Olympic. So the White Star Line were the owners of the Titanic and its sister ship Olympic. There was originally meant to be three ships of the Olympic class. And there was the Olympic, and then launched was the Titanic, and there was meant to be the Gigantic. But when you sink a ship as big as Titanic, you tend to think maybe we'll put the Gigantic on the back burner. So that's why you've never heard of the Gigantic. And interestingly, there was this massive fight going on, a corporate fight between the White Star Line and Cunard. Cunard had cornered the market in speed on these great ocean liners, these huge new ships. And the White Star Line decided that they were going to corner the market in glamour. And that really sets up the story for some of the shocking human error that is the reason that the Titanic sank. Because J. Bruce Ismay, the owner of White Star Line, wanted the world to know that this was an unsinkable ship.
Well, he described it as a lifeboat.
Yes, it was a lifeboat in itself.
They don't need lifeboats because really the Titanic is a lifeboat. And there is the beginning of the negligence, because they didn't actually put enough lifeboats on that ship to meet the needs of all the passengers.
Well, that the Titanic had capacity for 3,000 passengers. And in fact, that's how many people were waiting in New York once the Titanic was meant to dock there, who were going to be travelling back to the UK. So for 3,000 passengers, they ended up with, because J. Bruce Ismay thought that lifeboats made that top boat deck look very unattractive.
Because it's all about appearance.
Totally. Glamour, luxury, you know, anything super practical, really, we're going to have to think about that before we let that one go ahead. So they really should have had 64 lifeboats in order to accommodate 3,000 passengers.
And what did they have?
The Titanic sailed with 20 lifeboats.
Unbelievable.
With enough positions for 1,176 people.
Unbelievable.
Unforgivable.
Journalist and TV presenter Lisa Wilkinson's new book is called The Titanic Story of Evelyn. It's an untold story about Australia's only survivor of the sinking of the Titanic. And she's joining me anew at this Northern Books event in the regional Victorian town of Castlemaine. This is Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. It's great to have you with us.
Take us then to Evelyn and how she got there, how she landed on that ship.
Well, there's a moment that happens early in the book where her ability to read Morse code really has an enormous effect on her. I won't do any spoilers, but the Morse code message that she reads on that particular day means that she decides that she wants to become a nurse. So she travels down to Adelaide and trains at Adelaide Hospital, and it's while she's there that a patient needs a nurse companion to come with her to go back to the UK. And Evelyn has always dreamt of elsewhere. So she accepts that role as a nurse companion, and when she gets to London, she realises just how incredible elsewhere is. And so she signs up to be a nurse stewardess on cruise ships travelling all over the world, and she loves this life. And it's while she's on one of these cruise ships that she meets and falls in love with a handsome ship's doctor by the name of William Abel James. They become engaged to be married, and they're travelling the world. And they both then hear about this magnificent, very famous, supposedly unsinkable ship, the Titanic, and they both apply for him to be one of the two ship's doctors on the Titanic and for Evelyn to be a nurse stewardess in first class. They're both told, you've got the gig. But with just days to go, William is told, sorry, scheduling issues, you're going on the Macedonia, which is travelling to Sydney. And so Evelyn sails alone.
Just tell us, though, how you piece all this together, because this sounds like a complete story now, but it wasn't a complete story when you started. So what are the little kernels and the clues that give you a sense of Evelyn's story?
I mean, there was a
story. It reads like a novel.
Yeah, that was my intention, so thank you very much. Yeah. That was what I wanted to do, because I didn't realise just how many incredible stories there were on the Titanic amongst those just over 2,200 people. Mm. And I had to understand the stewardess experience. And there's a beautiful book called Titanic Survivor that was written by one of her co-stewardesses, Violet Jessop. And they had travelled together quite a bit. And in fact, they were both on the Olympic, which is the sister ship to Titanic, as I mentioned. That ship also had a pretty nasty crash. And that ship also was captained by Captain Smith, who was the captain who went down with the Titanic. So they'd already had that experience together. So this beautiful book that Violet Jessop, well, she actually wrote it just as a memoir for her family, but after she passed away, the family put it together as a book. And she was a beautiful writer, and she was so lyrical and poetic in the way she described the experience of being a stewardess and of being on the Titanic, that I could really marry up what I discovered, you know, beyond what I first found out at the very beginning.
What a gift. So it takes you inside the interior of Evelyn's life and experience on board. So the Titanic, when it launches, is mammoth. It's a mammoth media event. It's a mammoth community event. Just describe this vessel for us. I mean, the one statistic that stands out for me, other than the, it's something like, what, 52,000 tonnes, is 30,000 eggs were part of the cargo, and tonnes of meat and tonnes of vegetables.
Yes, I've got the full list of the bizarre and completely exotic and utterly expensive.
I mean, caviar.
Yeah, money was no object, particularly for those in first class. And you know, I've got so many favourite characters in this book beyond the wonderful Evelyn. I hope when you read the book you fall in love with her in the way that I absolutely did and have and remain. But I've tried to sprinkle throughout the book moments that will give you a sense of this rise of feminism that's going on. And some of them are very subtle stories, but they tell a much larger story when you put them all together. Mm-hmm. I want you to look out for one particular couple, William and Lucille Carter. William is heir to a massive coal mining dynasty. And he and his wife, Lucille, arrive on the Titanic with their coterie of servants. The only automobile that was on the Titanic
is theirs.
A very spivvy car is theirs, as well as a number of polo ponies. They also arrive with their two children, who are also called William and Lucille, because apparently that's what rich people do. They create children in their own image.
Oh, God.
So they're 10 and 12 years of age. And on the night that they hit the iceberg, William wakes Lucille up and tells her, "We've hit an iceberg. Please get the children up, dress them warmly, and I'll meet you up on deck." And I'm going to leave it there.
Yes, we haven't got to the iceberg yet.
Because what happens, it's towards the end of the book, but there's a moment of female empowerment that will have you cheering, ladies and gentlemen.
Can you tell she's worked in TV? Lisa, though, we also meet Molly Brown. And Molly Brown, alongside Evelyn, is my heroine in this story. She's an extraordinary woman in the suffragette movement. Mm. Tell us about Molly Brown, because she also becomes this phenomenal ethical figure at every point in this story, including after the survivors emerge from this horrible disaster.
Yes.
Who was she?
She, a very, very rich woman. She was almost divorced from her husband. Together they had a mine in America and they struck it rich. But she was fighting very hard for the suffragettes and for women in America to get the vote. She was very politically active, did a lot of social justice causes, and she's just a very significant figure in First Class. She's very well connected to the Astors and the Guggenheims and, you know, all of these massive American figures that are on the ship. Mm. But on the night, by pure happenstance, Molly Brown and two other very significant suffragettes all end up in Lifeboat 6. And all I can say is, you've got to feel sorry for Officer Hitchens. Because that poor guy never had a chance. And it took him a while, but he finally realised that these women were 10 times the man he was.
It wasn't just about first class. There was second class, there was third class, and there was the boiler room.
Mm, where the stokers were, who were the guys who were shoveling the coal. And that was hell down there. And they were incredible men as well.
Yeah. Who was in second and third class?
Well, really a mix. I mean, a lot of middle...
Incredible mix.
Yeah, a lot of middle-class people in second class. But third class was almost, without exception, people who were looking for a new life, leaving difficult situations from an incredible range of countries. And so these were families that were looking to a new life in America. But, you know, the sort of joy that they experienced in first class was, I would say, matched by the joy that they could generate down in third class. There was so much dancing and singing and just sheer joy at the prospect and optimism of the life that they were all heading towards.
And you really do get a sense of that in the film, don't you?
Yeah.
Starring Kate Winslet. It's the kind of multitude of classes, but the energy and joy on board. Okay, but it's not all joyful, clearly, because it didn't make it. But introduce us then to Captain Smith. He is a problematic character and you really cast him as such.
Well, it's hard not to. Captain Smith was actually on his last voyage. He was retiring after the Titanic. And it was a pretty dastardly combination. Captain Smith, who was very proud of his ship, the Titanic, and very connected to the first class passengers. You know, he really took a lot of satisfaction in the fact that he was so well connected to the rich and powerful. The problem is Captain Smith had a level of arrogance that I think was one of the major contributors to the sinking of that ship. For example, Captain Smith, despite the fact that he knew they didn't have enough lifeboats on that ship, he was a great believer that it was unsinkable. So Captain Smith, despite not having enough lifeboats, decided they weren't going to do any of the lifeboat drills that were mandatory, that would have tested the ropes, that would have made the ropes move more easily as the lifeboats, you know, were they to be used, would be lowered. So he wasn't doing lifeboat drills. That was mistake number one. He liked the idea, just as J. Bruce Ismay liked the idea, that while Titanic has got the market in glamour and luxury absolutely cornered, he quite liked the idea that on his very last voyage, they might actually be able to beat Cunard in the record that they had established between the UK and New York. And so between Captain Smith and J. Bruce Ismay, they were constantly putting up the speed and the distance that they were travelling every day for everyone to start placing bets on how much earlier they were going to be arriving in New York than was originally planned. So between them, they were ordering for the boilers to be fired up while they were in the middle of an ice field.
Mm.
Captain Smith was also ignoring all of the cables that were coming in from vessels that were in the area, all of which were saying, you know, we've stopped because you have got an ice field, the size of which and the southerly position of which we have never seen before. You know, we would recommend that you stop. And they didn't. Also, the guys in the crow's nest, somebody forgot to leave the key for the box that had the binoculars in it for the crow's nest. So Frederick Fleet was up in the crow's nest. It was approaching midnight and he's been told there's icebergs in the area, and the way the water ripples around an iceberg wasn't obvious that night, because it turned out that this particular iceberg had flipped. And so the iceberg was
black.
All of the scrapings that had come from when the glacier broke off, so you couldn't see the iceberg with the human eye. He would have seen it with binoculars, and he saw it way too late. So when he rang the bell and called down to the bridge, they thought, well, we've got five pairs of binoculars down here. We probably should have given them one up there. This constant layers of negligence.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And so the Titanic hits an iceberg. Let's pause there for a moment. Rewind. There's another woman on board, Edith Rosenbaum. She actually tries to get off the ship before it launches, doesn't she?
Edith is a fashion designer, fashion stylist. And she gets on because there's a number of stops after the ship, you know, first sets sail. And she gets on in Cherbourg in France. And the night before she sails, she goes with a couple of girlfriends for dinner. And on the way, they decide that they're going to go and see a fortune teller. Edith doesn't really care too much for fortune tellers, and her girlfriends get their fortunes read. But the fortune teller is a bit intrigued by Edith.
Well, Edith is an extraordinary woman.
Very much so.
She is an absolute doyenne of the fashion world.
Yes.
She's a writer, she's a fashion designer, she's a celebrity dresser, she's all of those things.
Yes. But the woman, the fortune teller, Madame de Teb, is fascinated by Edith, and whether Edith likes it or not, Madame de Teb is going to tell her fortune, because she's very concerned that Edith is going to be in a major disaster and that she's going to lose her voice. And Edith kind of shrugs it off.
And not just a major disaster at sea.
At sea.
It's that specific.
Yeah. And she kind of shrugs it off and still gets on the ship, but there is an unease ever after for Edith. And there's another woman on the ship that had a premonition, Esther Hart. Esther is on the ship with her husband and 8-year-old daughter, Eva. From the moment Esther gets on, she knows this ship is going to sink. And so Esther tells her husband and her 8-year-old daughter, I will not sleep. I will sleep during the day, but at night I am keeping watch. And she does that every single night until the inevitable happens.
And these are stories that have been written down afterwards.
Oh, yeah, they're very well documented.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what happens on the longest night, as you describe it, that long, dark night?
Well, initially, not a lot of people think that this unsinkable ship is going to sink, because there's a feeling from Captain Smith down that they don't want to cause chaos. But the designer, Thomas Andrews, who was in fact the second designer of the Titanic, the original designer, Alexander Carlyle, quit because he was in such a fight with J. Bruce Ismay over the number of lifeboats. Mm. So Thomas Andrews takes it on, but Thomas Andrews is very angry that Captain Smith keeps calling this ship unsinkable. And so once they hit the iceberg, Thomas Andrews pulls him into an office and shows him the layout of the ship and these so-called watertight bulkheads that ultimately are not watertight at all, particularly given the spot where they have hit the iceberg. It really was the worst possible spot.
Yeah, you got suitably nerdy about hull engineering, which I appreciated, I have to say.
I wasn't an expert before, but I am now.
Look, this whole scene that we're taking you into now, what was it like for you to occupy these next hours? Because it is truly devastating. And you take us through moment by moment. And Evelyn is there too, so let's keep Evelyn in our sights as well.
Yeah, well, Evelyn works out very early on because of her proficiency in Morse code. She is seeing the Morse code messages going out. She knows this ship is sinking, while many of the crew are still being told, we're not going to sink, we're just going to get, you know, enough people in lifeboats that vessel that we can see on the horizon, which was actually the Californian, they didn't know that at the time, but they could see a ship in the near distance that turned out to ignore them. You know, the captain of the ship was being told by his first officer, I'm sure that's the Titanic and I'm sure those are distress rockets that are going up. And there's a strange kind of tilt to their lights. But the captain of the Californian had a big day and he was a bit tired.
Went to bed.
And he said, no, I don't think that's the Titanic. Look, if anything changes, let me know, but I'm going to bed. And the way it works on ships is if the captain says that ain't the Titanic, there's not much the first officer can do.
So back on the Titanic, things start to get desperate.
So Evelyn knows that the ship is sinking. And initially there was, you know, a bit of calm. It wasn't too chaotic up on the boat deck. But as the ship is getting lower and lower, people start to get desperate. But the entire time, Evelyn, knowing that she probably won't get a spot in a lifeboat, is just securing the life belts of women and children. And she's seeing before her eyes families being torn apart, husbands and wives literally being separated. And she would have known that there is very little likelihood that these men are going to survive. So scenes of utter tragedy and devastation, but she just keeps women and children calm and making sure that she can comfort wherever she can.
And men are not allowed on those boats. Some try, but
Some succeed in the early lifeboats. There was this strange, inexact science going on either side of the ship, because on one side, one of the officers was women and children only, and on the other side, it was women and children first, but if there's none of those around, we'll let men in. And in one of the early lifeboats, 10 stokers got into one of the lifeboats. You know, a number of the rich men, you know, who possibly have been called, you know, were ever after known as cowards because they had survived. They got into those early lifeboats. But it's a tragedy that there wasn't more urgency. And again, the arrogance of these men who owned and captained this ship didn't realise how bad the situation was.
And the band kept playing.
Led by the wonderful Wallace Hartley. They played right until the very end. And in fact, today I was in Ballarat and I went to see the bandstand that was erected as a memorial to the 8 members of the Titanic band.
My guest on Big Ideas is journalist, presenter, broadcaster Lisa Wilkinson, and we're on board a sinking Titanic with a story that she's excavated, the story of Australia's only survivor, a 28-year-old nurse called Evelyn. Natasha Mitchell bringing you ABC Radio National's live event show from Castlemaine today, and you can hear us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. We don't want to give everything away, but why did Evelyn survive when so many of her colleagues on the staff, she was a first-class stewardess, so many others did not survive?
Well, a lot of the staff in third class and certainly almost all of the male crew didn't survive, and there were 900 crew on the Titanic. So there was only a couple of lifeboats left, and Evelyn, I think it was about a half an hour from the ship actually going down, Evelyn was helping women and children into lifeboat 16. And there was a couple of spots still left in that lifeboat, and a gentleman came up to her who'd been watching her for a while and said, "Get into that lifeboat." And she said, "Thank you very much, but I'm crew, I'm just helping women and children." And he said, "Get into that lifeboat. My name is J. Bruce Ismay. I own this ship." And
she remembers that moment.
Oh, yeah. And her husband, William, wrote to J. Bruce Ismay stating, you know, what exactly Evelyn had told him about the role that J. Bruce Ismay played in that moment. And I'm absolutely convinced, getting to know Evelyn over the last 3 years and what a humble and selfless woman she is, I'm convinced that the only way Evelyn could have ever made peace with taking a spot on that lifeboat is she would have had a look at those oars and known what a strong rower she was. And sure enough, Evelyn got in that lifeboat, because everyone who was in a lifeboat was told, when you hit the North Atlantic, and hit they did, you have to get as far away from the Titanic as possible, as quickly as you can, because when this 52,000-ton vessel goes down, she is going to suck everything in the vicinity with it. And so Evelyn got in that rowboat and she rowed like she'd never rowed before.
She was the woman for it. Take us there. There's an incredible scene.
Yeah, so they are in the rowboat, in the lifeboat. There's Violet Jessop, her fellow stewardess, and her are both in lifeboat 16. And as so often happened in the chaos of what was going on in the final half hour or so of the boat going down, a lot of babies became disconnected from their parents. And Violet was handed a tiny baby, parentage unknown, to try and keep alive. So that's the point that we're up to in the book. Evelyn is no longer rowing. Like the others, the oars rest across her lap and between her knees, still wet from the frantic push they'd made to get clear. Now, in the middle of this freezing ocean, silence settles over lifeboat 16 like a funeral shroud. The baby finally has stopped crying. She lies curled in Violet Jessop's arms, swaddled in a steward's coat, breathing in shallow little puffs, barely moving. They are out far enough now to stop, at least for the moment. The creaking of oarlocks has ceased and the murmurs have died away. What remains is only the sound of breath, gasping, ragged, staggered, drawn in and out by sailors and passengers alike who cannot believe what they are seeing. Titanic's bow is beneath the water's surface. The stern tilts upward at a degree that renders the whole scene uncanny, even from afar. Deck lights at the rear of the ship, which remain above water, still glow, row upon row, turning the ship into a floating half-palace, lit for a ball nobody will survive. From the lifeboat, Evelyn sees what she thinks are shadows moving across the lit portholes. Not shadows, people. Can she see some frantically waving? She's lower than when we left, Violet Jessop says quietly beside her. Much lower. Evelyn nods. She can feel it in her stomach, that pull downward. It seems to grip her soul just as it grasps that of the ship. She's still going. And yet no one can look away. Do you think she'll stay afloat? A woman whispers. She's not built to break, a crewman mutters in reply, but his voice carries no confidence. It takes all his courage to muster speech. And so Violet and Evelyn sit in horror, floating, waiting, hoping, watching.
Before that, there is also a terrible chorus that many of the survivors will probably never, ever get out of their heads. And that was the sound of hundreds and hundreds of people dying in frozen waters. And of course, many didn't, even if they got into a lifeboat, they didn't make it back. They froze to death on those waters before being saved.
Particularly in the smaller lifeboats, because there were 14 traditional wooden lifeboats and then there were six rafts and what's known as cutters, and they're sort of collapsible. And, you know, for those who were in those collapsible ones, a lot of them were up to their knees for hours in the freezing North Atlantic, and some of them just fell down and slowly floated away. And they were some of the saddest scenes that I had to write.
What was the impact of writing those scenes for you? I found it really gruelling. I mean, incredibly powerful rendering of this story by you. But to occupy these stories in the close way that you did.
I had many nights where I was dreaming about being on the Titanic. You know, it just, it completely consumed my life.
Mm. We will come to audience questions. I just want to find out what happened to Evelyn. Are we allowed to just give a little hint of what happened to Evelyn afterwards? And how she, is there any indication of how this voyage and this disaster changed her life? Because it certainly changed many people's lives, didn't it?
Yeah, in fact, that was one of my favourite parts of the book, was to write the epilogue.
It's extraordinary.
Because I really wanted to know, how does anyone who survives, you know, the most famous maritime tragedy that the world has ever known, how do they live with, you know, more than likely the survivor's guilt, when only 700 of the 2,200 or so who were on that ship actually made it out alive. And the experiences of all of them were so diverse. Some of them rose to absolute magnificence.
Molly Brown.
Molly Brown being one of them.
Well, she really lent in to supporting survivors.
Particularly the women from steerage. You know, she was magnificent in looking after them. She developed the Titanic Survivors Committee, and that was about making sure that those women who now literally had nothing apart from their children to support, many of them not educated, certainly didn't have careers, everything that they went onto the Titanic with was gone, their husbands were gone, and Molly recognised that, and she really rose to that challenge magnificently.
Bravery medals for crew, I think she organised a statue, and somehow she ends up as a nurse in World War One.
Yeah, one of her patients was Ernest Hemingway.
There you go.
In fact, many of the suffragettes who were in first class on that ship, they all became nurses in the First World War. You know, these were women who, whenever a challenge presented itself, they rose to that moment and surpassed all expectations.
And Evelyn?
Well, when Evelyn finally arrived in New York, the Carpathia was the rescue ship, and she had virtually no money. William, meantime, was halfway to Sydney when every ship at sea heard about the sinking of the Titanic, and there were survivors lists that were posted around the world. Evelyn's name wasn't on any of the survivors lists. And so her family back in Hoyleton, there were small stories that were appearing in the Adelaide press saying that there was a woman from South Australia and she's probably died because there's no mention of her in any of the survivors lists. And William knows Evelyn, and he knows that Evelyn more than likely would have gone down with the ship. But she arrives in New York. It's not until the very next day that she gets to the front of the queue to be able to send 2 telegrams. She has enough money for 2 words in the 2 telegrams, and she sends the same telegram to the family in Halton and to William. And the telegrams read, "Safe, stop, Evelyn, stop."
And you'll have to read the book to find out what happens to her next.
What I will say is one of the joys of writing this book is the beautiful love story between Evelyn and William, you know, so much of which was informed by getting those precious letters from Patria.
But what a gift to meet her.
Oh, incredible.
And she's quite an elder now, isn't she?
Yeah, she's 76 years of age, but, you know, her light for Evelyn is so incredibly strong even now. But in that love story, I won't do a spoiler on what happens at the end, but you know that Celine Dion song, "My Heart Will Go On"? I think it was written for William and Evelyn, because the thing is, Jack and Rose weren't real. William and Evelyn were real.
You've been living a great love story. And I think your publisher at one point said to you, Evelyn was sent to you to help you heal. You were writing this through a very, very difficult time. You were dealing with a defamation court case. It's been a rough ride the last few years. You've been in the public eye and the social media trolls, the whole bit. It's been pretty anarchic and hellish, and yet Evelyn arrives in your life at just the right time.
Well, she arrived in my life at possibly the lowest point of my life, and that was one of the reasons when I initially came up with this idea, and I said to Pete, "You've got to send this idea to your publisher," and he did, and within half an hour I got a call from his publisher Vanessa. And she said, "Lisa, everyone's talking about this incredible idea that you've had for Pete's next book, but we don't think we're going to do it." And I'll clean up what I actually said to Vanessa in response to her saying she wasn't going to do the book. But I said, "Are you kidding me? This is the best untold story Australia will ever hear." And she said, "Oh, no, we don't think it's a Pete book. We think it's a Lisa book." And I said to her, "Vanessa, I really appreciate your belief in me, but as you know, I'm going through this massive court case. I'm really at the lowest point I've ever been in my life. I don't know that I have the emotional strength to be able to do this book." And she said to me, "Lisa, I believe you can do this, and I'm going to leave that idea with you, and I'll call you in a few days." Well, Vanessa didn't wait a few days. Vanessa waited exactly 3 hours. Because 3 hours after that, news broke around the world that the Ocean Gate submersible had gone missing in the North Atlantic looking for the Titanic, yet another Titanic tragedy. So the entire world lent in. And so Vanessa said to me, "Have you heard the news?" And I said, "Yes, Vanessa, I have heard the news." And she said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "I think Evelyn and I are about to go on a journey."
And it's an incredible read, so congratulations. It's really finding readers very quickly. People are obviously really drawn to what you've created.
She's a magnificent woman, and she was almost lost to history.
Mm. Congratulations. Evelyn lives on in all our hearts. We'd love to take your questions, we'll go for maybe 10 minutes or so. Thank you.
I was wondering why Evelyn only did 2 interviews.
Because she was such a humble woman. And, you know, I mentioned the epilogue and how people dealt with the post-traumatic stress of having been on the Titanic. Mm. I believe Evelyn's way of dealing with that trauma was to continue to live her life serving others, and with enormous gratitude that she was lucky enough to survive when so many others didn't. There were plenty of people on the Titanic who gave many, many, many interviews. Mm. And that was their whole reason, I think, for continuing to have relevance, was to keep identifying themselves as Titanic survivors. And I say that with no judgment, because I don't think any of us could confidently predict how we would have reacted had we been on that ship and stared death right in the eye as that water continued to rise. And so I don't think she ever wanted to be...
Did she write down her story?
No.
No.
No, no, no.
So you don't...
But there were enough...
Letters?
...things in the letters that gave me a really strong sense of her. Mm. But, you know, quite often you hear about people who were on the Titanic and they would get asked constantly, are you that person that was on the Titanic? And I think there's a basic flaw in that question being asked, because I think for everyone who was on that ship that night, never really left the Titanic.
Yeah.
I think it stayed with them for the rest of their lives.
You mentioned, Lisa, there were 700-odd survivors. What was the mix between passengers and crew?
Well, most of the crew didn't make it, tragically. I mean, most of the crew were men, for starters, and there was only, I think it was 25% of the men who survived. And, you know, many of them were men who got into lifeboats when they shouldn't have, jumped in. There was a lot of, as lifeboats were leaving, men were jumping in before any of the officers could haul them back out again. But, yeah, that is a tragic statistic.
And Jay Bruce Ismay, the owner of White Star, he survived.
Yes, and he managed to find a spot in a lifeboat.
A real scandal.
Yeah,
so I was interested in how you kind of navigated the scandal, the mythology. There were claims and counterclaims. That would have been very interesting to dive into. There were a lot of accusations. You actually paint him in quite a positive light.
It was a very interesting exercise to work out how I felt about J. Bruce Ismay and Captain Smith. Mm. I wouldn't say I was their biggest fans. But with J. Bruce Ismay, I was very conflicted, because J. Bruce Ismay is the person responsible for Evelyn surviving. But, you know, certainly J. Bruce Ismay's arrogance and belief that this was an unsinkable ship was one of the major reasons why so many people died that night. And there were two inquiries there was one in the US as soon as the Carpathia docked and unloaded all of the survivors, because America was very angry that so many of their country men, women and children had died on this ship that was not of their own making. And J. Bruce Ismay appeared at that inquiry, and at one point one of the leading prosecutors said to him, you know, how is it that you survived when so many women and children didn't? And he was deeply offended at the question and asked, how on earth can you ask that question? Do you really believe I'm the sort of man who would get in a lifeboat when there were women and children still ready to get into lifeboats? Well, the answer is yes, because of 434 women, 130 didn't make it that night, and 62 children died, and that was half of the children. Mm. So you can make what you will of J. Bruce Ismay. But then if we go to the UK inquiry, just a sidebar here, the UK inquiry was a really flawed and compromised exercise, because that inquiry was run by the UK Board of Trade. Mm. And the UK Board of Trade was the government authority that had to make the final ruling on how many lifeboats were required on the Titanic. And the UK Board of Trade signed off on 20 lifeboats. So again, make what you will of the findings from that UK inquiry.
So you can see there's a journalistic mind that's been applied to this project, which is fantastic, but there's a wonderful literary talent here too. And so I'm curious to see if you write more historical nonfiction. I hope you do.
I've already got my next one in mind.
There you go.
I've got the bug.
That's fantastic. And we're all the better for it. Congratulations, Lisa.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here. We're going to have a book signing now. Let's thank Lisa.
The Titanic Story of Evelyn is Lisa Wilkinson's new book. It landed at number one in Australia's bestseller lists in its first week out. Titanic indeed. And she's got the bug for historical non-fiction now. I do too. It's addictive, so I wonder what she'll come up with next. Thanks to Northern Books in Castlemaine in central Victoria for organising this event. And if you're in another beautiful part of country Australia, this weekend I'll be hosting sessions at the Make Good Festival at Bundanon in New South Wales. Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au. Write to me. I'm Natasha Mitchell, back with you next time with more Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.